As Terry led us in prayer a few minutes ago, hope you prayed along. We're praying for those who are returning from the family retreat. We've got about 45 or 50. If you're visiting, you're going, where's the youth group? They're on a bus on their way back from retreat. About 45 or 50 people were down this morning from retreat. Several of us were there through last night, and we're here. We're here in body, sort of, but it's been a great weekend, and I look forward to hearing the stories of all that happened this weekend. That being, they left, by the way, they worshiped early this morning. They left about an hour or so ago, so they should be getting back in a little bit over an hour. That being behind us, our Ladies' Day is coming up, not this coming Saturday, but the following Saturday, the 27th of September. So all of our ladies are looking forward to that. And then we look forward to the month of October. We will have our gospel meeting later in the month of October. In the First World War, one of the things that made that war stand out in history was in the European theater, the trench warfare, where for weeks and sometimes months, soldiers stayed in the same trench, fighting for sometimes basically inches of ground across the European continent. As they stayed in those trenches, they were, of course, shelled. They often dealt with disease, and sometimes very tragic, but they dealt with the stench of death. But it's interesting to read some of the letters, some of the diaries that were written by those who were in those trenches for those long periods of time. Of course, they would describe the fighting and how awful it was, and those sorts of things, but many times they would write about how the fighting wasn't the worst part. They would write about how waiting was the hardest part. In fact, one German soldier in a diary wrote these words: "The waiting is worse than the fighting. The hours pass like years, and we feel forgotten by heaven and earth." How does it strike you when you feel forgotten? But let me ask a question you may have never thought you'd be asked in church before. How does it strike you when you feel forgotten by God? Just to hear that question may cause you to shudder. I mean, we're in worship. We're in church. We're singing praise songs. But in our candid moments, all of us have probably said, I know that feeling. I've wondered, does God still really care about me? Well, if you feel that way, or you have, let me give you good news. You're in really good company. In fact, if you open your Bibles back to the 13th Psalm, as we read that passage a few moments ago, that's exactly how David begins this poem. And by the way, if you like to mark in your Bible, this morning is going to be sort of a Bible marker outliner special. This is one you may want to have the outline in Psalm 13 for those moments in life when you do feel as if God has forgotten you. You just kind of feel alone out there. I'm trying to deal with something and I don't know how to walk through it. Psalm 13, as we read a few moments ago, contains just six verses, but there's some of those powerful, emotionally packed six verses found anywhere in the Bible. It is of interest, and you'll see this as we go through the text, that those six verses very easily divide into three two-verse sections as David progresses through his feelings in this difficulty. But if you look above verse 1 in your Bible, those little letters, we sometimes call them the superscription. Sometimes the text will tell you the background or something. All this one says is something like, to the choir master of David. Yes, this was a psalm the people sang. Can you imagine David Eisen walking up here and singing, our first song this morning is, how long, O Lord, have you forgotten me forever? That's not exactly what we sing in worship. But God wanted this poem in the Bible. And He wanted His people to sing it. One reason I point out the superscription also is what's not there. You see, sometimes in the Psalms, you might think of Psalm 51, you have in the superscription the background. This is when this poem was written. 51 is after David had been caught with Bathsheba and all that came about that we know when that was written. Other Psalms, and this is one of them, we know who wrote it, we know David wrote it, but we're not sure when. You can look at commentators and what they'll suggest to you is their best guess, and that's all it is, but they say probably David wrote this during that period of time when he was on the run from King Saul. They get that partially because in verse 2 and in verse 4, you have him referencing my enemy. But they still have to say he probably wrote it during that period of time. But we don't know. And even if he did write it during that period of time, you know, sometimes we think about David running from King Saul, we think of it like it lasted like a week or two. It was over a decade, at least intermittently, that David ran from King Saul. So even if it was during that period of time, we don't know when during that period of time. And I say that to say this. I'm glad we don't know. Because it's easier to apply this poem to my life. If I don't first have to go, well, I've never been on the run from a king, and so I can't make the application. No, but I've sometimes felt like you have, as if God has forgotten me. And what I want to do this morning is walk through these six verses with you to see what David writes out of the absolute depths of his soul in a moment when he felt as if God wasn't there at the beginning, because spoiler alert, he remembers at the end he is. And maybe when you're walking through a valley, these six verses will help you. Verses 1 and 2, David writes about his struggle. Of course, the opening verses all open with questions, but what's interesting is what David does in these first couple of verses is express the feelings of his heart. But if you read these questions very carefully, it seems as if whatever this situation was is just all-consuming in his life. There are four lines of questions. First of all, David says he feels forgotten. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? That word forget is a perfect translation. You could actually translate that word as ignore. Will you ignore me forever? And the word forever can also in the Hebrew mean continually. And since David is writing this as a series of questions, it's almost as if David is saying, God, I've brought this to you before. I've brought this to you forever. And you're ignoring me. You ever felt that way? You ever been going through something for weeks or months or even years, and it's as if you have knocked on the throne room of God continually for what feels like forever? And you know the clouds aren't going to part, some light's not going to shine, and God's going to go, oh, here's the answer to the situation. And it feels, because of quote-unquote the silence, as if God has just ignored you. But David goes further. Because not only does he feel forgotten, he also feels forsaken. Because the second line, he says, will you hide your face from me? What a powerful image that is. This is David. This is the man after God's own heart. Basically saying, it's as if I have knocked on the throne room of God's, the door, excuse me, of God's throne room, and not only has God not answered, he's turned the other way. He has turned his face from me. Will you turn your face? When Jesus was dying on the cross, he uttered those seven sayings or seven words. One of the more famous ones and heart-wrenching ones, my God, why have you forsaken me? Who wrote those words? David did in Psalm 22. This is the man after God's own heart. And he says in the moment, it's as if God has ignored him. And in fact, God has turned his face. You ever been having a very serious conversation with someone, and it's not just because of miscommunication or something like that, but they know this is something that means something to you. This is something that is agonizing on your heart. And they just turn the other one. How emotionally devastating is that? Now, hopefully we give some grace, but it hurts when that happens. And David says that's what it feels like that God has done to him. But he goes further, because not only does he feel forgotten and forsaken, he also feels frustrated. That's that line that opens the second verse. The question there, how long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? David's talking to himself. Now, I know nobody here would ever do something like that. And I know nobody here would ever do anything like that, going through a difficult time, going around just talking to yourself, right? Now, whether David is literally, vocally speaking to himself, what he's basically saying is, I'm frustrated with the fact that God hasn't given me an answer, and I'm trying to figure all of this out. I'm having to take counsel in my own soul. To the point that it's causing me sorrow, he says, all the day, or day and night. All the time, my mind is just consumed. This is why I said that this the situation is just consuming David. The sorrow is on him all the time because God hasn't answered and I can't figure it out. Ever been there? And he goes further because he also says he feels fallen. The last question of verse 2 where he speaks about his enemy, how long shall my enemy be exalted over me? If the enemy is King Saul or King Saul and his soldiers and those sorts of things, David is basically saying, I don't want this one who's against the ways of God to have the higher place. If, as some commentators suggest, it's not King Saul and it's just some difficult situation in his life that David is personifying as an enemy, he's saying, I don't want to have that enemy, that difficulty, to have the higher place, to be exalted. Literally here, the word is to be lifted up. David is basically saying, I've moved down the pecking order here. And we can also just imply from that, assume from that, he's basically, and I'm trying to do what's right. And all four questions or lines begin with the same words. How long? It's as if David is saying, I know there was a starting point to this. I know when this began. But as I look back on when it began, it's starting to get a little bit foggy because it's getting way on back there. But even if I know when it began, I for sure can't see when it's going to end. If it's on the run from King Saul, I don't know when that's going to stop. If it's just a difficulty in life, a circumstance in life, I don't see an ending point. And David is struggling within himself. And don't you love that God wants these verses in the Bible? That he says it is okay to say to God that it's as if you aren't there and you're not listening. But aren't you also thankful that David didn't set down his pen? Because he keeps writing. And in verses 3 and 4, he writes about his supplication. Verses 3 and 4 are more than just a prayer. You know, in the Bible, we have these different words for prayer. Prayer just being the general term for speaking to God. But sometimes you have the word supplication in the Bible. That's a word we just don't use all that much, except in church world. But the word supplication basically means an emotional appeal. Sometimes you'll see it described as begging God. And as David continues, almost said Paul wrote this psalm. As David continues in this poem, he has talked about the struggle he has, and now he begins to talk about what he is saying to God, what he is making an appeal to God for. And in verses 3 and 4, he specifically mentions three things that he is supplicating. He is begging God to have happen. First of all, he says, perceive me. He opens verse 3 by saying, consider me and answer, O Lord my God. The word consider there literally means look intently upon. It is as if David is saying to the God of heaven, I want you to shut everything else in the universe down and put your eyes on me for a moment. That's a pretty bold prayer to pray. And he goes further by saying, I don't want you to shut everything down and listen to me, but I want an answer. Maybe that answer will be yes. David, you're going to be victorious. Maybe. You don't like where this is going, do you? Maybe the answer will be, David, no, you're not going to be victorious. But I want an answer. And what David is saying is, God, I just want your attention. I want to know that I still am in your view. I want you to perceive me. Out of all the things going on in the entire universe, I want to know that when I am begging you about this situation, that you perceive, you're looking intently upon me, and that an answer is coming my way. And he goes further by also saying, preserve me. Don't just listen to what I have to say, but then he says at the end of verse 3, light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. You ever known somebody who was going through a very difficult time, and you didn't know they're going through a difficult time, but you walked, maybe at church you walked up to, or maybe somebody you worked with or something, and you just saw something in their eyes that gave it away? And just naturally you ask, are you all right? And man, they were smiling. I mean, they were at church. They had a suit and tie on. Right? I mean, everything was great, but something in their eyes, something in their countenance gave them away. We can picture David with his pen in hand, with red eyes maybe from crying, with bloodshot eyes maybe from exhaustion, to the point that he says, I want to be preserved unless I sleep the sleep of death. If the prevailing view is correct, that David's writing about King Saul, then this is literal death. I want you to get me out of this or I'm going to die. If this is simply meant to be a difficulty that's personified as an enemy, then David may mean by this that I don't want to go through life as if I was dead. Just devoid of the things that make life worth living. But whichever it is, David says, I want you to preserve me. I want you to lift up my eyes. I want you to help me to see things properly and have joy and life and peace in my eyes. And then, God, I want you to protect me. Verse 4, lest my enemies say, I prevailed over him, and lest my foes rejoice because I'm shaken. Your translation may say something like, lest I have fallen, something along those lines. The Hebrew word literally means to totter. Now pause just for a second. David is saying here that I don't want my enemies to see me be weak, tottering, shaking. You're going, well, yeah, I can see that. And he's saying that to God. Well, yeah, I can see that. What's implied in that? He doesn't see God as his enemy. Even though he's just said, God, will you forget me forever? Even though he's just said, this is frustrating, this is difficult, he still doesn't see God as the enemy. I don't mind being vulnerable or weak or tottering before God. That's who I need to be, weak and tottering and vulnerable before. But once God has helped me with this, I don't want my enemies to see me weak and vulnerable and tottering, because I don't want them to gain control over the situation. That is a bold prayer. That's why we call it a supplication. This is from the absolute depths of the heart of David. And you may look at those things and think, yeah, it may not have been as eloquent and for sure not as poetic, but I've prayed very similar things to God before. And even there, if David set down his pen, this would not exactly be the most positive psalm in the whole 150 found in the book. But aren't you thankful he keeps writing? By the way, aren't you thankful the very first word of verse 5 is the word but? Because what David does in the final verse is talk about a song. His mood changes, but how does it change? If you read verses 5 and 6 carefully, how it changes is he takes a moment to truly think in an honest way about the God to whom he is speaking, even in a very bold way, and about the God to whom he is supplicating and pouring out his heart. As he writes about God in these final couple of verses, they're words that should fill all of our hearts with a reminder that even though things are going to be difficult, even though we are going to go through times where we struggle, and even though we might wonder at times, does God really care? These same thoughts about God can fill us with reassurance that He really is there and He cares. He writes about trust. When he speaks in verse 5, I have trusted in your steadfast love. But Terry read from the New American Standard, it has loving kindness. Some translations here have mercy. The Hebrew word here, you may have heard it said before, the word hesed or hesed, it's pronounced a couple of different ways. That's how it's most commonly translated in the Bible, steadfast love, kindness, loving kindness, mercy. It is a deeply rich word. But when this word is used to speak of God, God's loving kindness, God's mercy, those sorts of things, it is best remembered and best viewed when we remember that God deals in the realm of covenant. Here's what I mean. Think of the book of Exodus for a moment. In Exodus chapter 1 and verse 8, you have God's people in Egyptian slavery, and Exodus 1:8 tells us that a king arose who did not know Joseph, didn't remember what God had done through him, and those sorts of things. And the opening couple of chapters of Exodus, things get tougher and tougher and tougher on God's people. They're enslaved. They're made to do brutal work. They have no respect at all. And you get to the end of Exodus chapter 2, and you have these couple of verses, Exodus 2, 23 and 24. During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. They were supplicating. They had a struggle, and they were supplicating. Verse 24. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered His covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Pause for a moment. When the people cried out to God in verse 23, from their perspective, did God automatically go, problem solved, taken care of, you're out of slavery this very second? It is a long time before Moses comes on the scene in Egypt. It is further time where they go through the 10 plagues and then finally are led out of Egypt through what we call the Exodus. They could not have seen in the moment that yes, God heard their cry and God was doing something. We don't like to hear this because it means I have to be human, that God doesn't work on our timetable. But I also always need to remember that God works within the realm of covenant. He will never break His covenant. Ever. I might. But He won't. And so you come to the New Testament, and we're reminded in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5, He said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Right? That's God's promise. But guess what I can do? I can stop trusting Him. I can walk the other direction. Until I remember His steadfast love, His mercy, His loving kindness, and trust in that. And then David writes some words of triumph. When he talks about the fact that there will be victory or there will be salvation, the end of verse 5, the word there for salvation is a word that can also be translated as deliverance. So if it's King Saul and David says, God's going to give me deliverance, God's going to give me salvation there, or if it's just a difficult circumstance and God's going to, quote unquote, get me out of this, God's going to deal with that. So I'm going to be joyful in that. That's a triumph. God has won. Here's a question, though, for a moment. What in Psalm 13, where in the poem, does God break in and say, oh, by the way, David, here's how it's all going to turn out? It never happens. It's not in there. So what if David lost the battles? What if David never was delivered from the difficult circumstance? Are you listening? He would still know the deliverance of God. Isn't that what the book of Revelation is all about? The book of Revelation makes it clear that people who are faithful, they were Christians, they were wonderful folks. They're struggling with stuff, but they're wonderful folks. And yet the book, even though there's a lot of symbols and signs, it's hard in places, very clearly tells them, some of you will die because you are faithful. It very clearly says that some of them will go through economic difficulty, imprisonment, and other things because of their faithfulness. And you go, well then, God hasn't delivered them. Yes, He has. That's the rest of the book. Jesus will always be the rider on the victorious white horse. Jesus will, the devil and sin and death will always be thrown into the abyss and burned up in the lake of fire and brimstone. Those who have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb will always be at the marriage supper of the Lamb and have access to the tree of life forever. That's how the book ends. God wins. If I never get out of the difficult circumstance, if I'm never delivered from this situation, if I lose to all of my earthly ministries, I have triumphed because Jesus has already won. David understood that 3,000 years ago. But sometimes in my difficult times, I forget to remember it. And so David ends with words of thanksgiving. I will sing to the Lord. Notice the terminology. Because He has dealt bountifully with me. Wait a minute, David. You started this poem talking about an enemy. And God's not even listening to you. You feel... But I remember who God is. He has dealt bountifully with me. And even in this difficult circumstance, no matter how long it has gone on, no matter how long it will go on, God still deals bountifully with me because He's God. I'm breathing because of Him. You may be walking through a very dark valley. And the opening part of this psalm may make a lot of sense to you. God, are you really listening to me? Do you really care? Have you turned your face? And those sorts of things. I don't say this to be trite. I hope you don't hear that. But sometimes some of the simplest words we ever sing teach the most profound truth. When upon those life's billows you are tempest tossed, when you're discouraged, thinking all is lost, count your many blessings, name them one by one, and it'll surprise you what the Lord has done. If you're a Christian, no matter how dark the valley is in which you find yourself, God has still promised you His presence. He has still given you forgiveness. He has still given you prayer. He has still given you a church family. And by the way, at Central, He has given you the very best one. He has given you His Holy Spirit. He's given you His Word to help us to know what He would have us to do. He's given you the hope of heaven. He has given you everything that you didn't deserve any of it. And that's reason to thank Him, even in the midst of the darkest valley we might ever walk through in our entire life. In 1970, the Apollo 13 crew was very infamously or famously just out there. Basically, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. They were roughly 200,000 miles from home. That's basically the equivalent of going to the equator and walking around the Earth 9 full times. That's how far out in space they were. And you read transcripts from the mission. And there's moments where it goes very clearly from this is the mission of what we've gone to do to things have very much changed. It all begins famously. Yes, it's in the movie too, with that line, okay, Houston, we have a problem here. You think? And from that point on, the workers in Houston and the crew on a ship in the darkness of space had one goal. Come home. But think about what that crew did. They went to the ones who could help them get home. That's what makes that historical story so powerful. Is everyone worked together to come out of the blackness of space and go home. We worship the God who controls space. And we worship the God who at times I may wonder, does He really care? Is He really listening? And then I remember, He's done everything to bring me home. A poet has written these words. And before I read them, let me remind you that in the moment we extend the invitation, we began a few weeks ago You can, of course, come forward. If you have something more personal, one of our elders and his wife will be in the back to speak with you. I want to mention that because I know this sermon has been very personal. And maybe something has caused you to not want to respond publicly. Maybe you want to speak to one of our elders. Poet's written this. All the bitter, weary ways. Endless driving day by day. You barely have the strength to pray in the valley low. And how hard your fight has been. How deep the pain within. Wounds that no one else has seen. Hurts too much to show. All the doubt you're standing in between. And all the weight that brings you to your knees. He knows. He knows. Every hurt and every sting, He has walked the suffering. He knows. He knows. Let your burdens come undone. Lift your eyes up to the One who knows. This morning, you may be singing, but it may very much be in a minor key. It may feel like that soldier in the trench, where hours pass like years, and you feel forgotten by heaven and earth. It's time to go to the One who will bring you home. If you need to come to Him, will you do so? Always stand and sing to encourage you.